The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by the Mysterious Package Company. Are you or someone you love a fan of Lovecraftian mysteries? Then you must check out MysteriousPackage.com/paranormal. That's MysteriousPackage.com/paranormal. Thanks, Mysterious Package Company. And the Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Scott Evest. Whether you're a ghost hunter or a gadget guy or girl, tons of pockets in your clothing, well, they just make everything better. Also, they are fantastic gifts. To learn more and get a super special Scott Evest deal, go to jimherold.com/vest. That's jimherold.com/vest. Thanks, Scott Evest.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. And boy, do we have a treat for you this week. I think the show clocks in at something around 90 minutes. So this is really along that line of expanding the Paranormal Podcast and bringing you two interviews every week. And these are two great ones. We're going to start out with psychic George Anderson. We're going to talk about his new book, Life Between Heaven and Earth, What You Didn't Know About the World Hereafter and How It Can Help You. And then we're going to do something quite different with an old friend and many time guest on the show, Tom Ogden. We are going to talk about haunted Washington, D.C. So if you're not frightened enough by the election, this should put you over the edge. But that being said, we don't get political here. We're everybody's friend. We're certainly looking forward to this show, and we hope that you enjoy it as much as we did putting it together for you. So here is the Paranormal Podcast. This show covers what I think is the most important topic in the range of Fortiana or the paranormal or the supernatural, whatever you want to call it. And we talk about a lot of different things on this show, everything from UFOs to Bigfoot. We have the big tent philosophy. But when people ask me, Jim, late at night when you lay your head on your pillow, what topic are you really the most curious about? And it's the afterlife, because think about this. Not all of us will see a UFO. Not all of us will see Bigfoot. Maybe not all of us will see a ghost or have a strange experience with a Ouija board. But I hate to break it to you, we're all going to die. At least we are on this physical plane. But our guest today, I know, believes that there's something far beyond that, and we're going to talk about that. And he really is a superstar in this area. We're talking about George Anderson. We're going to talk about his new book, Life Between Heaven and Earth, What You Didn't Know About the World Hereafter and How It Can Help You. George is the first medium in history to appear regularly on a cable television show. He's also the first medium to gain international exposure for his extraordinary ability and the only medium to be cleared by network television standards and practices to appear on the first ever primetime special on mediumship, Contact, Talking to the Dead. He is also the only living medium to have been invited to Holland by surviving members of the family of Anne Frank, and he remains the most scientifically tested medium on Earth. He's been featured in newspapers and televisions, and he is the New York Times bestselling author of George Anderson's Lessons from the Light and the national bestseller Walking in the Garden of Souls. His new book, along with his late co-author Andrew Barone, is Life Between Heaven and Earth. George Anderson, welcome to the program today.
Thank you kindly.
So, a little bit about your personal history. I mean, you're very accomplished. Obviously, you have all these great credentials. You're a New York Times bestselling author. You're not a bestseller on some arcane list, you know. did this start at an early age for you? Did you know that you had this gift, this ability from an early age?
I would say the ability strongly manifested itself after I had a severe bout of chickenpox at the age of 5-6, and not 56, between the ages of 5 and 6. And it was after that, but you know, naturally at that age, it's just put off as, you know, childish fancy. And then at the age of 14, it started to show itself in a more pronounced manner. And that's when I started thinking to myself, you know, what's going on here? I was inclined to keep it to myself and just letting it go to see what would happen, so to speak. And later on, of course, when I did speak about it, naturally people think you're a nut. And it wasn't until, you know, I was sent for psychiatric help and so forth, they thought they diagnosed me as being a paranoid schizophrenic. They were going to institutionalize me. Fortunately for me, one of the last psychiatrists I was interviewed by that had was, you know, for the state hospital they were going to put me into, he just seemed to look at me as if I had six heads, and I overheard him go outside to my parents and say, I don't even know what he's doing here. Get him out of here. It's probably that wacko Catholic school he's going to. You know, just take him home, let him have a rest, whatever. And that's what happened. So the final 2 years of high school, I was tutored at home. And, you know, I really put the kibosh on the ability because I thought, uh-oh, this is, you know, getting me into trouble. Something's wrong here. And later on, when the subject matter became more openly discussed, is when I started, you know, talking about it or letting it come forward again. So I guess for a while there, it was embalmed. And, you know, then all of a sudden I allowed it to come to pass again.
I always ask people who are mediums this particular question because I'm fascinated by it. How and what do you experience when these spirits communicate to you from the other side? What does it feel like, and how do you distinguish the real communication from just a mental blip? How do you get the wheat from the chaff, and what do you experience?
Well, most of the time, and it still intrigues me to this day, where anybody out there wants to contact me, be my guest. I'm looking for a doctor/scientist who wouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater and try to... The thing that fascinates me is how do they get into my brain, so to speak. It's almost like you can feel them using it as a file cabinet or as a reference, where maybe not all the time, but I would say 98% of the time, they will find something, even things that happened 30 years ago. I remember I was doing an appointment by telephone not that long ago, and a woman had come through, and keep in mind, I will not allow anybody to volunteer any type of information or who they're hoping to hear from or whatever. And it turned out this man had lost his wife. And as, you know, the session progressed, I'm always hoping that, you know, the individual who passed on, their name will come through. And she kept showing me a Christmas card I had received from a friend I had worked with when I worked in the telephone company years ago. And the thing that stood out about the card at the time is I always called her Lori, and she had signed it Love Laura. And I brought that out to this man's attention, and it turned out his wife's name was Laura. And the thing that really intrigued me is how did this soul from over there, how were they able to find something that happened to me over 30 years ago?
Right.
And show it to lead me right into the direction of what her name is, her name was. And, but then sometimes also, you know, you can kind of, once I think I allow my nose to get into the session, I can mess things up or misunderstand things. Not many times, but, this one lady who had come and had lost her daughter. And of course she was quite, needless to say, you know, devastated over the loss. And I kept seeing this particular saint that I've always had great devotion to, Saint Philomena. And normally, Saint Philomena can represent several different things, from the name to happy birth, you know, whatever. So I started to interpret it from past experience. And the woman looked at me as if I came from Mars. And finally, I said to her, look, I think maybe I'm making a mistake. I keep seeing Saint Philomena appearing behind you. Do you understand? And she said, yes. I said, okay, I'll keep my big trap shut and proceed, which I did. But after the session, I had to find out what I misunderstood. And I normally, you know, do not, you know, talk to people. And I said to her, I'm going to break my own rules here. I said, I have to ask you. I kept seeing Saint Philomena appearing behind you. Can you tell me what that meant? What did I do wrong that every interpretation I thought it would mean was incorrect? And she told me that she had prayed to Saint Philomena and asked her to bring her daughter to her spiritually. And she said that one day in her home, when she least expected it, out of the corner of her eye, she saw her daughter in spiritual form. And, you know, her face was radiant with white light and such. And that's what that meant. So it would have been so much easier from the beginning if I would have said, I see Saint Philomena appearing behind you. Do you understand? Yes. And just left it alone. Sometimes you can try to interpret from past experiences of what the interpretation may mean, and it may not necessarily be the case. So as I'm getting older, I'm trying to do my best to keep my schnoz out of the session.
But something you mentioned, this spirit from the other side pulling information that you experience, does it hint at the idea that once we cross over, we become aware of all knowledge? We become almost all knowing in a way. The souls over there know so much more than we know over here. Does that follow?
I would say not necessarily. The one thing I have found out is that when we do pass on, I don't know where this ever started from, but people are inclined to think we suddenly know it all. And we certainly don't. How this individual managed to find that information in my brain, as I said, from 30 years ago, I don't know. But most of the time, like when they reach out to me, I would say sometimes I would think they're talking to me. Sometimes it just feels like that. And, you know, but again, sometimes things can be misunderstood. But one thing the souls have said from over there is that, you know, they don't suddenly wave a magic wand and make everything go the way we may like. They can help us to help ourselves, but they cannot interfere in our spiritual experience. We're all individuals on our own experience. You are, I am, everybody listening is. And what they do is, you know, they kind of can help us to help ourselves, but they can't interfere. Sometimes, though, they have you know, somebody's really walking into a disaster and just refuses to see it, they may say something to me like, you know, tell them this is not a good idea, but basically, ultimately, it's all up to us. You know, we're always in the driver's seat, which I prefer. You know, I don't want anybody leading me around by the nose here or hereafter. And that certainly is not the way you would expect it. You know, there's people out there who'll think, you know, when they pass on, St. Peter's going to meet them at the pearly gates. I have yet to hear that. And there are, you know, there's people I'm sure listening that, you know, would be atheist, agnostic. I certainly have my agnostic days, you know, because of not being able to fully understand the ability, or again, when it doesn't work the way I think it should, thinking that it's not working, but it works the way it's supposed to. You know, I have nothing to do with that. So, you know, many times, I mean, I would consider myself predominantly a free thinker, even though I still have, you know, specific spiritual devotions. I try to steer away sometimes from the word soul and try to more use consciousness, because I do think that's what survives what we call physical death. Some individual, some consciousness is, go over there and they'll think they're dreaming and aren't ready to, you know, accept the fact that they've passed on. Some individuals go over there and when they realize they're not dreaming, you know, they want to complain to the management. They're pissed off because, you know, hey, I had a nice life with a lovely wife and family, and I'm young, I'm not supposed to be, what's going on here? So it's very interesting that every session is a unique experience. Some sessions, for example, I was brought up in a dysfunctional home. Just about every one of my friends came from a dysfunctional home. We're inclined to attract into, you know, into our lives almost things we, people or things we can relate to. But yet there are, which it took me a while to finally believe and accept, that there are people who came from what I normally call, for a shorthand purpose, you know, a meet me in St. Louis home or leave it to Beaver home.
Right.
There were people who did come from loving, embracing, joyful homes. I will be honest with you, most of the sessions I have, you know, can make your blood run cold. But every now and then, I will get a session where somebody has lost a dad, a mom, a sibling, whatever, and, you know, they're distressed, but they certainly came from a loving and an embracing home. And somebody observing that session may say that, you know, the information coming through is general. But as the consciousness from the hereafter says, I can't come in and create a horror story just to make things sound more dramatic. They're actually thrilled to be able to come forward and rekindle, you know, a happy memory and joyful times and such, because many people have never experienced that here.
Now, let me,
because even I'll be cynical. I'll say during to myself during this session, oh, anybody could say that. But the point is, it's not anybody. It's this individual's loved one bringing that joyous memory to them.
We'll be back on the Paranormal Podcast right after this. Don't touch that input interface on your device. Or in other words, don't touch that dot. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by the Mysterious Package Company. Are you or someone you love a fan of Lovecraftian mysteries? Then you must check out MysteriousPackage.com/paranormal. I'll tell you, this is the most unique sponsor we've ever had on our programs in 11 years. With Mysterious Package Company, you can get the most unique gift that your friend or family member will ever get, and they'll never forget it. It's unlike anything they've ever gotten before. It's more than just a package or a series of packages. It's an experience. Imagine you're going about your business and you get in the mail a mysterious letter or package from a sender you've never heard of. You open it up, and in it you encounter a series of cryptic and historic objects. Maybe it's a yellowed playbill or a 100-year-old newspaper clipping or a strange artifact encased in a small crate that needs to be opened with a crowbar. And that's what happened with us. We talked to the folks over at Mysterious Package Company and said, you know, this sounds like a great thing. I think my listeners would love it. So they sent me an experience. And I'm not going to spoil it, but it came in a series of mailings. And me and my daughters, who love mysteries and Lovecraftian type things, we went through it and the detail and just the mystery. Now, I got it, and I'm like, who is this from? And I was expecting it. So just imagine if a friend or family member gets this out of the blue, you buy it for them as a gift, and then they go through this strange experience. It's kind of like, in some ways, being in the Da Vinci Code in real life. It kind of reminds me of that movie, The Game. Your recipient becomes the hero of the story while sifting through all of these mysterious artifacts that are part of the experience. Now, don't buy your loved one something they'll just throw in a drawer and forget. Give them something that they will always remember. Now, the good thing is there's experiences for people of every age, from teenagers on up. And imagine sending a friend a package full of mystery, wonderment, and something that makes them think in a good way. And you can do so. Check out mysteriouspackage.com/paranormal. Now, when you navigate over there, you'll be in for a bit of a mystery yourself. I'll not spoil it, but just go and become a part of the experience yourself at mysteriouspackage.com/paranormal. That's mysteriouspackage.com/paranormal. Check it out. It is very neat. I think you'll love it. Thank you, Mysterious Package Company. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is George Anderson. Now, let me ask you this. Now, I think a lot of us, even those of us who believe that we live beyond this earth and our physical body, that we go somewhere and have this spiritual life. I think there's a big, in most people's mind, there's a big separation. You know, we're here, they're there. They may dip in occasionally if somebody such as yourself who has a talent gets us in contact, but they're really not involved in our daily lives. They can't be involved in our daily lives because we're just very separate by the nature of the veil. First of all, do you find that most people believe that? And second of all, if they do, is that accurate?
Well, many people, I think, here on the earth would be inclined to think somebody over there can, you know, step in to save the day. Once again, they can if we ask, because, you know, nobody can stick their nose in there unless you ask them to. They can if we ask them to help us to help ourselves. But sometimes people may feel like in a prayer or something, you know, they don't receive the answer they would like. And I've come to learn to accept that somebody over there may know better and not want, cannot interfere. And I think when you really think about the transition we call death, because this is one thing, you know, the individuals over there have said, most people are not afraid of the actual transition. What they're afraid of is what will lead up to it. You know, nobody wants to, you know, die in some horrible accident, right, or paralyzed or suffer with cancer for years or something of that nature.
Right.
The actual moment of transition, they've told me, is like walking from one room to the next. They've even made a joke about it, saying you can You know, you can practice at home. Walk from your bedroom out into the hallway, you know, and just, oh, I just passed on. There certainly are, you know, the skeptics out there. But then I always wonder, are you, you know, there's nothing wrong with skepticism. You know, I'm probably the worst defender of them all, even with my own ability. But the thing is there's a big difference between a skeptic and a cynic. A cynic who just says completely impossible, whatever, you know, people like me are, you know, taking people for a buggy ride, whatever. I certainly don't believe I'm doing that. You know, somebody recently had, you know, mentioned about, you know, you shouldn't be, people believe you shouldn't be charging for, you have to. I mean, I can't live on hope. I wish I could.
Right.
Then I thought to myself, too, you know, a friend of mine, his mom just recently passed on, and, you know, I was aghast at finding how much the funeral cost and all the additional fees and all this that are connected with it. And, you know, so again, you know, everything has its price, but at least I can say in my case, it's your choice and it's once in a lifetime. You know, if you believe it, good for you. If you don't, we're all going to find out sooner or later, as you said in the beginning of the program.
Now, what about people out there who want to contact a past loved one? What guidance would you give them?
Contact in the sense of coming to see me or...
Well, that's one possibility, yes. You know, if
well, the thing is, I always tell people to, you know, go on the website, georgeanderson.com. You know, because we are still trying to get things back in order again with the passing of the co-author, who was also the administrator. But things are falling back into place, and hopefully, you know, very soon everything will be in a sense of orderliness. But sometimes, you know, people can themselves, without going overboard, can look for signs that, you know, a loved one may send them. Again, you know, many of the programs that I watch on TV, on the different cable stations, you know, about hauntings and all this, you know, some of it I look at with, I really don't buy this. Some of it's very interesting. But again, until you learn it for yourself, I don't think anybody knows a thing. Can I prove to you beyond a reasonable doubt there's something after death? No. But one of these days, you're going to face it, and so am I, and we're going to learn it for ourselves. And I feel it's a win-win situation, because there's only two things that could possibly happen. One, you'll go to a place that's, you know, very peaceful and much nicer than here, even though this is the proving ground. So I want to make it look like I'm trashing our existence here. I believe we're the souls in purgatory, if you want to look at it that way. Mm. Or you're just going to fade into nothingness. So heads or tails, you're going to win, because if you fade into nothingness, you're not going to know the difference. But if having a receiving comfort in believing that that individual is still with you and you're going to see them again for the time being that you're here comes to pass, you know, keeps you going, that's great. Because I mean, you pass on and you just go into nothingness, well, then you go into nothingness. You won't know the difference anyway. You know, they have reminded me from over there that very simple lesson we all learned in science class: energy can neither be created or destroyed. And even though we're in the physical body and the brain dies and whatever, I think we're still an energy.
Right.
And here for a purpose, everybody, even if you don't think you are. You know, some people have come here and, you know, passed on and said, you know, they had a very happy, fulfilling life. They loved it. Some individuals have come through, some consciousnesses have come through and said they hated it here. They were so glad when they finally got out of here. And, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of people listening right now who would feel that way. But ultimately, until we learn it for ourselves, we have to put a question mark on everything. Mm-hmm. I feel anyway. You have to constantly question it. Yes, maybe be a little skeptical, but not cynical. That's the difference. You know, just, you know, even years ago, I did an experiment with a doctor in New York City. And, you know, no pun intended, you didn't have to be too psychic to figure it out. Before we even started the experiment, I could just tell he had made up his mind, this is bull, period.
Right.
He was cynical, and even if I had changed water into wine, you know, he still wasn't going to buy it. But the thing is, and yet I saw another in the book, We Are Not Forgotten, another neurologist who had done an experiment on me. Now, I would not say he was certainly not a cynic, but he wasn't somebody that, you know, you could pull the wool over his eyes either.
Right.
And he saw in the experiment, changes that in my brain that he couldn't explain. And yet this other neurologist, he says, well, he saw nothing happen. But you had already made up your mind nothing was going to happen. And, you know, there's certain things I certainly feel, and I'm sure you do too, that you've made up your mind about, or you feel, or you believe, whatever, nobody's going to change that. You know,
right.
I still do, I totally despised the changes in the church, the Vatican II changes. You know, to me, they just destroyed the spirituality, the heart and soul of the church. And, you know, I certainly am not a religious person. As I said, at this time of my life, I would pride myself as, you know, leaning more toward being a free thinker and being agnostic, because yes, we can have these experiences, but we just don't know until we know. Until we cross that threshold, we're not going to have, you know, any idea. I have to, you know, from the experiences I've encountered in the sessions I do, there's just too much has happened where I can't say to myself, well, it's all, you know, bull. Something is happening. Different theories have been thrown out. Maybe I'm not communicating with the consciousness of somebody's loved one out there. Speculation has said maybe I'm using 10% more of my brain than the average person, which is possible. I'm open to any explanation that somebody could give. Just because, you know, you just can't come up to me and say, well, it's bull because I feel it's bull.
Seems to be like a common held belief among the uber skeptics. I don't think there's anything wrong with being skeptical with this.
No.
Somebody said skeptical with a small S. You got to watch how you say this too. Skeptical with a small S as opposed to a big S.
Yeah.
You know, and I like, you know, I like the skeptics with a small S. Those who have a big S, well, I'm not as big of a fan. So we do enjoy on this program and on these programs that I do stories. And certainly people should pick up the book if they want to really get the full scoop in all of these different stories. But could you share a little bit of one story in the book with us to give us a flavor of what we could expect?
Well, one story that's in the book that I found very interesting is a soldier that returned from duty over in the Middle East, and he had shown kindness I believe he was in Iraq, and he had shown kindness to this young Iraqi girl. And, you know, when the militants got wind of it, they ended up killing her.
Oh.
And, you know, he felt a sense of responsibility. And, you know, she had come through in his session and, you know, basically told him it wasn't his fault, you know, that, you know, she appreciated his kindness. But one thing, and I think for once I was glad I did my best to keep my mouth shut, because I kept seeing during his session, and I kept feeling like I was hearing the name Duke. Now I'm thinking to myself, anytime I've heard the name Duke, it's usually been somebody's nickname or a pet's name or whatever. And sure. I started to go in that direction thinking that that's what was happening. And somebody over there got hold of me and said, like, you know, don't put in what you think, just tell him what you're seeing. And I said to him that I keep hearing the name Duke. And I said to him, do you understand? He said, yes. I said, okay. And, you know, left it. I didn't question him afterwards. But I found out later on, and, you know, this was a unique thing to have happened, but I don't want people to get the wrong idea that it happens in every session or somebody could set it up this way. This young soldier had been skeptical, and he had said afterward, before the session, that if it were real, I would, you know, talk about the Duke, meaning John Wayne. Which I never thought of that until after it was mentioned. So that he felt was verification to him that what he was experiencing was real. But, you know, I always tell people, be very careful. The consciousness over there says, refuse nothing, ask for nothing. And I think that's the best way to experience the session. Don't go in with any preconceived expectations, because then I think you're really setting yourself up, which could be a tremendous disappointment. Some woman had come to me years ago who had lost her brother. She came to see me. She was not happy with the session because her and her brother had worked out like a code word or something. And even though she heard from her brother, just because that code word didn't come through, she threw out the baby with the bathwater. And I thought to myself, your poor brother, he must be like, maybe it is something he could not get me to understand. You know, probably the older I get, the more knowledgeable I become, things might become easier. But, for example, I'm no linguist. I may hear what sounds like another language over there, but not know what language it is. I'll just say to the people, I'm hearing another language. And I had said that one night, and apparently the subject I had, you know, was inclined to be very skeptical. He said, yeah, but you could say that to everybody. Everybody's family spoke another language before they came to the U.S. And I looked at him, I said, you couldn't say that to me with my WASPy name. Come on. Even my middle name. I mean, you can't get any more WASPy than my name. So what language do you think has been spoken in my family since the beginning? English. It was like, oh, I didn't think of it that way. You know, well, think of it that way. You know, I've done that 23andMe on both my father's side and my mother's side. You can't get any more WASPy than I am. You know, definitely. I said, well, because, all right, my mother, you know, brought us up Roman Catholic. My father's side of the family are Anglo-Catholics, you know, the Anglican Communion, Church of England. Right. And, but there's the evidence that the only language I ever heard my family was English.
Well, I'll tell you, we have been talking in English, and it's been a fascinating conversation. And George, I have one last question before we go, and then I want to certainly tell people where they can go to your website and find your books pretty much everywhere. But I have one other question, and it's a little sensitive, and I hope you don't think it rude, but I often think about psychics in their personal lives. You know, you hear the old saw about the shoemaker and the shoes, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
How is that for you when you have somebody close to you? And I'll even say this, and I mean no disrespect and my greatest sympathies, but your co-author of this recently passed. Is it something where you stay away from contacting people in your family or maybe friends who have passed, or is that something that you actively pursue as well?
I would have to say no, because I don't think the ability is for me. I think the ability is for people out there. I don't think it's for me. If I do at times see what you may call an apparition or something in my house, it's usually one of my pets that have passed on, probably because they know I'm not going to give them a hard time and I'm always happy to see them. But when it comes to it, it just doesn't seem to work for me. I can give, a friend's loved one may come and give me a message,
right?
But they can do that because they know I can deliver that message.
Right.
But, you know, my parents have passed. You know, my favorite aunt just passed away 2 years ago at 91. And I will be honest, I don't feel that I've ever received or saw like a unique experience having to do with them, in my opinion. But I think that's wise, because I don't think the ability is for me. I'm just the instrument. That's it.
That's fascinating. I appreciate your honesty in that. Well, it's been a great conversation. I appreciate it. The new book out is Life Between Heaven and Earth, What You Didn't Know About the World Hereafter and How It Can Help You. Our guest has been George Anderson. George, where can people find the book, and where can they find more information about all of your work in general?
Well, I know that, you know, naturally the book is on Amazon, and that's where I bought my copies that I gave out to family, you know, and in any of the known bookstores. And right now, again, to go on my website, it would be georgeanderson.com. I'm not very computer savvy, so I think there's Twitter, there's a Facebook page, and things of that nature. So, you know, that can be contacted. But as I, at this time, explained to people, because of the sudden passing of the co-author, you know, things are still, we're trying to still get the nuts and bolts in order. And, you know, I'm helpless because I don't know a thing. I mean, I can't go on eBay and Amazon, but anything technical, I haven't got a clue. I don't even know how to use a cell phone.
But You can communicate with the other side, which is quite a gift. It was quite a gift indeed. George Anderson, we thank you so much for being a part of the Paranormal Podcast today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, I enjoyed that talk with George Anderson. I love getting insight from people who can see beyond the veil on the other side. Because as I often say, I'm sensitive as a board, but I do believe there is something over there. And any time we can get a peek at it, I am utterly fascinated. And I'm also utterly fascinated by ghosts and by history, and that's why this next segment's going to be a lot of fun. Tom Ogden on Haunted Washington, D.C., right after these very important messages. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Scott eVest. Whether you're a ghost hunter or a gadget guy like me, well, tons of pockets in your clothing, well, they make everything better. And really, you need to discover the power of pockets. Now, I hate to say this, but I'm going to say a four-letter word on the show, and I don't do this very often. And the four-letter word is fall. Well, I love fall, but we know what comes after fall. But the temperatures are going to start getting biting here going into September. And it's time to start thinking about that fall wardrobe. And I can't think of anything any better to have than a Scott E. Vest piece of clothing. Now, that can be one of their fantastic vests. That can be one of their jackets. They have pants, shorts, polo shirts. If you can sew a pocket into it, they have it. But I absolutely love it because people like me carry around a lot of stuff. I said earlier I'm a gadget guy, and it's true. My wife says I'm addicted to electronics and used to never have any place to put them. And that is until I found Scott E. Vest. For example, I have their Quest Vest, and that one has 42 pockets. You can even fit a full-size tablet in it. It is fantastic. Water bottles, gadgets, cables, anything else you can think of. Then they've got full-on jackets. For example, I have their System 8.0, which is basically two jackets with 39 pockets. You can wear them together or separately, and those are great for the wintertime. And then they obviously have lighter jackets and lighter clothing for warmer temperatures and warmer climates. Really, wherever you are, Scott E. Vest has a piece of clothing for you that will make your life easier. I think about all my friends out there in the ghost hunting community. What a great thing. Put all those meters and cables and recorders. You've got someplace. I think that you'll love it. It's Scott E. Vest. And I've got a deal for you. If you'd like to save 20% off your Scott E. Vest purchase, go to jimherold.com/vest. That's jimherold.com/vest. Click on the link I provide there and use the coupon code JimHerold. That's very important that you do that. You need to use that coupon code, one word, JimHerold, JimHarold, and you'll get 20% off your purchase. What a deal. Discover the power of the pocket. Go to jimherold.com/vest. That's jimherold.com/vest. Click on the link I provide there and use the coupon code JimHerold, and you'll get 20% off your purchase. Thanks, Scott E. Vest. And over the course of doing this for the last 11 years, you get your favorites, people who, when they have a new book out, you definitely want to have them on the show because they have great books and they're great people. And I have somebody on the line like that today. I'm talking about Tom Ogden. He's one of America's most celebrated magicians and a very, very accomplished author. And he's done a lot in this world of haunted states, haunted places, haunted things, haunted Hollywood. I think he's done haunted cemeteries, haunted colleges and universities. And now he's turned his attention in election year, which makes a lot of sense, to haunted Washington, D.C., federal phantoms, government ghosts, and I love this, Beltway Banshees. We're so glad to have him on the show once again. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I was very proud of the Beltway Banshees.
I like that
subtitle.
There's a lot of names you could come up with for politicians. I think that's a good one. Well, now Washington, D.C., I've always kind of viewed it as almost like a mystical place. If you look at the architecture and the way it was laid out, it was very planned with the Masonic tie-ins and so forth and all
Absolutely.
Of the symbolism and the obelisk of the Washington Monument.
Dan Brown wrote a whole book on that,
right?
About the secret hidden symbols in Washington, D.C.
Right. So I mean, I'm sure that the fact that it was their election year came into play here, and then also that kind of thing. So tell us, what makes Washington such a haunted and kind of ethereal place in some ways?
Well, those are two different things. I think it's ethereal just because, as you say, the mysticism of it, the country decided to create a city. Not unlike the capital, Brasilia, of Brazil. Instead of putting it in Sao Paulo, their biggest city, or Rio, they decided to make a city in the middle of the country that would be a brand new city just for its government. We had 13 colonies, a new country. The obvious capitals had been between Philly and New York mm-hmm. at different times, but no individual state wanted to cede to another state
right.
the federal government. So the Congress asked, well, they they had to accept land. The states had to cede the land that they were willing to say, we no longer control this. And they got several different offers, but they decided to go to a central location because, of course, they were going all the way from New England to Georgia. So the natural spot was Midway, but they didn't want to keep it in Philadelphia. So they took what was basically swampland at the time on the Potomac River. And Maryland and Virginia both gave part of their territory to create this diamond-shaped district, which is 10 miles on each side. Now, if you look at D.C. today, it's kind of half a jagged diamond because Virginia eventually decided to withdraw from the city. And the reason was the compromise that allowed it to be the city to be placed where it was, because it was so close to the George Washington's estate, they didn't want federal new buildings being built on the west side of the Potomac. And eventually Arlington and Alexandria said, we're always going to be the left behind part of the district. We'll be the suburbs. So they said, you know, we'd rather go back and be part of Virginia.
Interesting. Working
where, yeah. And I should make a point of when I say this, since people who are listening are saying, but I want to talk about ghosts, not history. This particular book, of all of the books I've written, really is a history primer because it's hard to appreciate the hauntings of Washington, D.C. unless you know them in context.
Sure.
Of who these people were and why they chose to haunt these particular places and why those places were important in American history. And it gives a much greater appreciation for these particular phantoms.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think the city just being built from nothing, and as you say, Washington and Jefferson and one other man whose name I forget formed a commission. They chose the architect, Lafont, a French architect, to make the neatly planned wide boulevard city. Contrary to popular opinion, the dead center of the district is not the Capitol building, although it does seem to be. It's very close of where the four cardinal points meet. But all the main streets and avenues came out in sort of a ray form from that area, from the area between Capitol Hill and the White House. So it was neatly planned from the beginning. So it had this mysticism. And for today's visitors, you know, I have to confess, the publishing house asked me to do this book because they are going more and more into regional titles.
Sure.
And they wanted one for Washington, D.C. And they knew it was a great time publicity tie-in because it was released during the presidential election year. And I'd been to Washington many times. I grew up on the East Coast near Reading, Pennsylvania. And I had visited many of the places. So I thought, okay, that will be fun to research and do. But it just kind of, as all writers will tell you, it just sat there for a while looking at the blank page, thinking, oh, do I really want to get back into this again? And then, as you mentioned, I am a professional magician as well. And I booked two naval bases in D.C. and visiting again and seeing the monuments. And it's just so inspiring to any American to stand on the Mall and look around and say, this is my country. I mean, it's hard to explain the feeling that you're overwhelmed by just being there.
Right.
And it got me passionate about researching the ghosts and even more than when something would come out and say, oh, I was there. I just saw that. Oh, that really? There was a ghost in there? I didn't get to check it out? So now I'm looking forward to going back for my next trip to follow up some of these places.
Now, you you can't think of Washington, D.C. without thinking of the White House. But I guess it's important to let people know that the White House was not there, obviously, when America was founded, that it was a process of creating this house in the way that it, and it's evolved over the years, as I understand it.
Yes. When it was originally designed, Washington approved an architect that he had seen a state building that he had seen down in Virginia, that he approved that architect to design the White House. And at that point, it didn't have the porticos on the front or the back, you know, where you see the president giving addresses looking over the lawn.
Sure.
It didn't have the West Wing, which is where the Oval Office and the presidential offices now are. It didn't have the let me think of West. It would be the East Wing, I guess, would be the other side of the White House, an extension where the First Lady has her offices. On each side of the White House, if you're standing out on the north side, looking what we, well, actually, yeah, I guess most people consider that the front. They know the rounded portico is the backyard overlooking the White House lawn. It did not have the porticos on either side. Thomas Jefferson added those, and they were added actually originally just for, they were hiding the laundry room. It just was to hide things originally. And then other people, Franklin Roosevelt, built the West Wing, the building on the far side of one of those porticos. Said, you know, the White House is getting pretty crowded. We need some more office space. Let's make a whole new building. So, yes, it has changed over the years. I was very lucky. Today, it's not difficult, but it takes a lot of advanced planning to get a tour of the White House for security reasons.
Of course.
And the Capitol, you used to visit a lot more of the interior of the Capitol. I would suggest to any listeners who want to do either, go through your Congress people, mm-hmm. either senators or representatives. And if the request is put in by them, not only will you get higher in line than the average tourist who waits till they get to D.C. to try to do it, but many times those tours include more buildings and places within them than the regular tours.
Now, not only has it changed over the years, it seems that maybe some of the former occupants have decided to stick around a little bit, and they've been seen and heard from.
Interesting, and yes, and that's why I made that the first chapter of my book. The Haunted D.C. I put into five parts. The first part was just the White House ghosts, and the second part was just the Capitol and things on other places on Capitol Hill. Then there were a lot in Lafayette Square, which is the park area just north of the White House, where a lot of people in the 70s and early 1800s moved, society people, because they were close to power. They were close to the White House. And then out in Georgetown, which is a part of the District of Columbia, it is not Washington, D.C. City. Washington City is the federal city within the D.C. District of Columbia. So they're not synonymous. And then the fifth part was the catch-all, everything, the rest of the story that I hadn't told. But among the presidents, let's look at just the presidents' ghosts who are in the White House. People have heard Thomas Jefferson playing his violin in the Yellow Oval Room. They've seen President John Tyler. Andrew Jackson has shown up and actually scared the heck out of several people in what is now called the Queen's Bedroom. It used to be called the Lincoln Bedroom, but it's now the Queen's Bedroom because it was the guest room most often for visiting heads of state from other countries and several queens, including Queen Wilhelmina, who saw Lincoln's ghost in that room. They've now changed the name of that room to the Queen's bedroom. William Henry Harrison has been seen in the attic. And not only, but of course, the one that most people have seen is Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll know from other podcasts and other people talking to you, Lincoln gets around. there have been claims of Lincoln's ghost in the White House. A few, but only a very few, in Ford's Theater where he was assassinated. Instead, more often, people have heard footsteps of John Wilkes Booth in Ford's Theater. But Lincoln's ghost train appears, the funeral train appears along portions of the track that it followed from D.C. back to Springfield, and his ghost has been seen at the Springfield Cemetery itself, where he's laid to rest. But he's been seen in different parts of the White House. Robert Sandburg, the poet, said that he... No? Yes, yeah, Sandburg. It wasn't Robert Frost. It was Sandburg. Carl Sandburg,
yeah.
Said that he had felt, and maybe Frost too, that they had felt Lincoln's spirit in the Oval Office, which is not today's Oval Office. The White House has this feature. You know how the portico in the back is a semicircle?
Yes.
The back of that, of the White House building, there is a circular room. It's actually an oval room, which juts out from the back of the building. And it was an architectural feature that was very popular at the turn of the 18th, the turn of the 19th century, 1780s to 1810, that era. And it's on all three floors. Well, the first floor, the second floor was originally the offices, but when Roosevelt built the West Wing, they moved the offices over to the West Wing. So it's no longer an office. But each of those rooms has a different name, and the yellow office, Oval Office, is where John Tyler's been seen. Andrew Jackson's appeared in the Queen bedroom. What is now the Lincoln bedroom, which Lincoln did not stay in? It's called the Lincoln bedroom because the furnishings are things from either that Lincoln used or were from the era of his administration. His ghost has been seen in there by Maureen Reagan, Ronald Reagan's daughter, and also Churchill, Winston Churchill, on one of his visits during World War II, stayed there. And when they say the Lincoln bedroom, it's actually a suite. There's the bedroom, the sitting room, and there's the bathroom attached. Winston Churchill, this wonderful story, he comes out of the bath, still completely stark naked, smoking his ever-present cigar, which he smoked even in the tub, and he looks over to the fireplace, and Abraham Lincoln is standing there, of course, fully clothed, and Churchill said his first words were, "Sir, you have me at a disadvantage." But
that's
on
great.
Future visits, Churchill moved across the hallway to stay in the Queen's bedroom.
Now, let me ask you this. Most of these sightings in the White House, have they been more of the kind of sense of a residual haunting where just somebody seen walking by or so forth? Or has there ever been any kind of attempts to communicate or anything? Or has it just been kind of like you'll see Abraham Lincoln walking around?
Haven't been any verbal communication interaction. But there have been knocks on doors. Now, for instance, when Queen Wilhelmina was staying at the White House, there was a knock on the door, on the bedroom door. She opens it, and this is bedtime, 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night, and Abraham Lincoln is standing there.
Wow.
So, like any self-respecting woman of that generation, she fell into a dead faint. And the next morning, she excused herself and moved out of the White House, moved over to Blair House, I believe. But whether that was residual, that it was from a time that Lincoln had gone there, or whether it was active, that's really up for discussion.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we go to another great landmark in Washington, of course, Capitol Hill. Tell us about Capitol Hill.
And I almost started with Capitol Hill. The White House and the Capitol building, and for the former English teacher in me, will remind your listeners that Washington, D.C. is the capital of the country with an A, but the building, the right. Capitol building, is with an O. That is the Capitol. And that was Thomas Jefferson, by the way, who insisted on that spelling. But anyway, they share a ghost story. In both basements, there is supposedly a demon cat, a black cat that appears at a time of imminent crisis.
Oh, my.
And it's a warning omen. And you'll see it in the distance, and if you walk toward it or it approaches you, it grows in size to, like, first, you know, a German Shepherd and then a wolf, and then will eventually disappear. I mean, it's never attacked anyone. But it appeared, for instance, before the Lincoln assassination, and it appeared before the stock market crashed. Although, there have also been reports of it occurring not on bad times, just changing times, like during right before a presidential inauguration, you know, change of power.
Wow.
But it's been seen in the sub-basement of the White House. There are actually two or three, well, there are even more basements now.
Right.
But there was originally a basement and one sub-basement, and that was where the cat was originally seen. And the cat is seen in two flights below the rotunda level in the Capitol, down in the area that was Washington's, was built, designed to be Washington's tomb. There is a circular room in the basement. The original plan was that the rotunda level, which has, and that's the same level that has the statuary hall that everyone's seen that picture. Those are not in the rotunda, by the way. They're in the next room adjoining the rotunda. It was originally planned to be a glass floor, or originally an open floor with ropes around it so you didn't fall in, and you would be able to look down two stories.
Oh,
that there'd be a hole in the next, in the basement level, and then down in, you would look down onto the crypt. Just the way, if you've ever seen pictures of the way Napoleon Bonaparte is buried in Paris, that his mm-hmm. crypt stands, that you can be up on an upper level looking down onto the crypt. But it wasn't finished by the time Washington died, and when it did get finished 30 or 40 years later, they just declined to move his body from his estate over to... from Mount Vernon over to the Capitol. But it's still there. I mean, and that room has also been, there has been a soldier, U.S. soldier, seen guarding that and then walking out of the room. The basement also, the original architect of the Capitol, L'Enfant, of not the Capitol building, but who planned out the map of Washington, D.C., because he felt he never got paid.
Huh.
He was fired. He was apparently a very irascible person, and it had to be his way or no way, and he made the original design, which is basically what we see today, but there was a planning commission for Washington, D.C., and they said, yes, but we need this, and, you know, we can't run that there because there's a canal there, And he didn't want them tinkering with his plans. So even though Washington considered him a friend, he finally let L'Enfant go. And he was paid in part, but he had run up so many debts during the years chasing his final payment that he basically died penniless. So, and he is seen carrying a big roll of paper under his arm like architect blueprints.
Oh, my. Now, it strikes me that Capitol Hill over the last couple of hundred years have been filled with a lot of strong personalities, shall we say. I mean, I can just think about people in the last 50, 60 years, Sam Rayburn, Tip O'Neill, Lyndon Johnson, who most people forget was a big power in Congress before he was president. I mean, I think of these people trying to sway legislation and having all these arguments, a lot of emotion. And we've talked before when we talked about some of your other books, places that have a lot of emotion tend to have more of these sightings and these kind of things. Did you find that at the Capitol, and did any of these big personalities show up?
I have not heard any returns of from anyone from past around the 1930s.
Okay.
There are two former speakers of the House who apparently show up pretty regularly in the House chambers. And I had no idea who, I didn't know their names, but I wrote them down because I knew we might talk about them. Joe Cannon, who was a Republican Speaker of the House, and Champ Clark, who was a Democrat Speaker of the House, both in the early 1900s, and by that I mean 1900 to 1910, that era. And even after they were no longer speakers, they were still in the House. You know, when the other party got power, they were still a representative. And they fought all the time arguing on the floor. And night guards will say that they will hear a rapping of a gavel in the House chambers. And when they'll go in and investigate, they will hear the sounds of two men yelling at each other. Their ghosts haven't been seen, but they have been heard. And the pounding of the speaker's gavel has been heard. Another haunting from the 1900s there is a blood stain on a staircase, one of the Marvel staircases, which now actually goes down to the senator's lunchroom. But a congressman named William Talby from Kentucky was shot by a reporter for the Louisville newspaper, a guy named Charles Kincaid. And Kincaid had uncovered the fact that Talby had committed adultery, which, of course, in that era was, you know, enough to get you voted out. But he never was. He seemed to be able to rise above all of the fray. But Kincaid kept pushing him and pushing him, and Talby, instead of ever answering the accusations, could just kind of brush him off like he was a fly. You know, just out of my way. Kincaid was fired from the newspaper, but he stayed in Washington as a lobbyist because he knew everybody and knew all the connections from his time as a reporter. And on one day, they met back, and Talby pushed Kincaid aside, no more than, it wasn't a fight, it was just more of an out of my way little man. But it broke the proverbial straw, and Kincaid went back to his apartment or house, got a pistol, came back and shot Talby as he was walking down the staircase. And of course it's been cleaned up, but there's still a reddish stain that they have never been able to get out of the stone. It's not been tested to prove it's a blood stain, but it's just one of those creepy, weird things. But as far as people like Tip O'Neill or even Ted Kennedy or, you know, some LBJ from his blustering period, LBJ has not. In fact, I have never heard stories of LBJ's ghost returning anywhere, even to his ranch in Washington or the White House.
Yeah, that would be interesting because he had a very strong personality. So you think if anybody would have returned, it would have been him. I mean, some of the things.
Or a residual ghost pushing their emotions onto an environment while they're alive.
Right.
You might think it would be on that presidential bathroom that he conducted business
from. Yes, with the door open and
to intimidate his guests.
I know that was in the recent biopic of him by Bryan Cranston, who was tremendous and really transformed himself into LBJ. But that was a real thing because I had read that in other historical biographies and things about that. That was an intimidation technique. He would be conducting his stately business on the presidential
throne
commode and would be talking to his aides, which must have been very distasteful. But I think that's the way he meant it to be. A place that comes to mind, and actually I think about this. My daughter, who just turned 13, was very fortunate this last year with her school, and they went to Washington, D.C., and like a lot of school kids do, but she got to tour some really cool places, and one of them was Ford's Theater. And I believe they actually saw a play there, if I'm not mistaken. And I understand Ford's Theater is one of the places that you looked into.
Yes. Ford's Theater was immediately closed after the assassination because the government didn't know, even when they found out they knew immediately who did it because John Wilkes Booth was a famous Shakespearean actor at the time. They didn't know if there was a conspiracy within the theater that someone in the theater had allowed access to Lincoln. So they closed it down. For years, it was then just a government warehouse and offices were there. The National Park Service, and I don't have the date, but it would have been in the 1900s, said, you know, this is an important historical place. It should be reopened as a museum. And part of the agreement of how it was opened, it once again became an active working theater. They do not do a lot of... it's mostly original productions. It's not a large theater, so you're not going to get Cats going in there. It'll go over to the National Theater or the Kennedy Center or one of the other large theaters. But I've seen a show in there back in the 80s, I guess. And every so often there'll be a presidential gala from Ford's Theater that you'll see aired on PBS. I know because a couple of magician friends of mine have been on some of the bills. But it turns out that because Ford, whose name I'm blanking on, the Ford of Ford's Theater, also owned a theater before that up in the Baltimore area where the Booths were from. And they knew each other. So that when Ford built the new theater down in D.C., he had already used not only John Wilkes, but his brother Julius, another Shakespearean actor, as actors in his plays. So very early on, Booth had been an actor there, so he was intimately familiar with the theater. And Booth was, before the night of the assassination, he had already met with other people at the Surratt boarding house planning originally not killing Lincoln, but originally they were going to kidnap him, turn him over to the Confederate Army for ransom or to give up the war effort. But once the war, and he actually attempted to do it once, but Lincoln decided that day not to go where they were going to abduct him along a road that he was going to travel, and Lincoln changed his plans, so that didn't happen. Well, after Lincoln was reelected and the South lost, Booth realized, no, there's no reason to kidnap him anymore. Now we'll just kill the guy who betrayed our country. And he happened to be, the morning of the assassination, Booth, because he traveled so much, had his mail delivered to the Ford's Theater. And he went in to pick up his mail. And someone there at the theater that morning said, oh, did you hear? The president and first lady are coming to see our American cousin tonight. Huh. And Booth immediately walked across the street and engaged his getaway horse from a local stables, went back to the boarding house, called his people together, and you know, it was part of a larger conspiracy. They were also going to kill the vice president that night, and they were going to kill, was the Secretary of State? They're going to kill three people that night. And the other two men, one attempted to kill the vice president. No, the vice presidential guy gave up and just went to a bar. The other one they attempted, but he was caught in the act, and he escaped and fled. Booth, of course, succeeded. What has been, his ghost has not been seen, but there have been footsteps heard on the stairs that went from the backstage area to right behind the presidential box. Today, you can't go into the presidential box. It's closed off. You can stand down in the orchestra and look up at the box, you know, and they have the commemoration ribbon, but you can't actually go in it. So they're not hearing people from backstage walking around back there. And then there was the famous Matthew Brady picture that after the assassination, during the following week or two, he was brought in to take pictures of the interior of the theater. Now, I don't know whether it was for archival purposes in case the theater was torn down, or whether it was part of the investigation for people looking what Booth's path might have been, an escape route. But he took a series of photos, and, you know, those were the old glass plates. And on one of the pictures, there is a cloudy figure in the presidential box, and people believe that who have seen that believe that the stature, height of it, that it is Lincoln, not Booth.
And the thing is, if that's a ghost photo, that is probably the first recorded ghost photo.
It would be absolutely. And of course, like everyone else, is that story true? Because I've tried to find that photo. You know, and I've written the archives saying this photo I hear about must exist, but I can't find it in the Brady archives. So if any of your listeners do, have them send it to you.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I'll let you know on that. I mean, these are just, we talked about the White House. We've talked about Capitol Hill. We've talked about Ford's Theater, but we've really just scratched the surface. You look at a lot of different places in this book, don't you?
Oh my, there's more than 30. There are close to 50 different haunted places I've mentioned. And I've got to mention one in particular, though, that is not a ghost story. But if anyone goes to D.C., you have got to do this. I went back and revisited the Exorcist steps. You know, that was about demon possession and exorcism, the book and the movie, based on a true incident, by the way. So the steps really have nothing to do with a haunting, even though the house at the top of the staircase, not the one that was supposedly the one that the McNeil family lived in, but the one on the other side of the staircase, is haunted. And it's haunted by the woman who owned it in the late 1800s, and she was a spiritualist medium. The staircase was built for the trolley or tram company that had the last extension out into the district before the river ended in Georgetown, right by what is now Key Bridge, at the foot of that staircase. And the staircase was built so that the residents up on the bluffs of Georgetown could get down to the trolley. That's why the stairs were built. And the house itself, the Exorcist house, and that is not the house where the true story took place. That was out in the suburbs. But the house sits back 40 feet from the staircase. So the famous scene at the ending, I don't think I'm ruining anything by telling this ending. Anyway, the end scene could not have occurred. They had to build a fake side to the house in order for the big climactic scene to have occurred. But still, I went back on my last trip and went there at midnight and just sat on the stairs. And it is such a creepy feeling, because of course there's the mist coming up from the river, and sure, it's quiet. Friedkin, when he filmed the movie, used a lot of the local area as exterior shots, including some interiors of Georgetown University. So that whole area there, you get the feel of, it just feels uneasy. So I would say, go see all the haunted stuff. Go to Lafayette Square. Go see the haunted tomb in the lobby of the Smithsonian Institution, you know, but give yourself a few minutes to go out to Georgetown. And of course, there are also several haunted museums and homes in Georgetown that you can visit that I also mentioned in my book, but time doesn't allow to go through all of them.
Now, I know in addition to Haunted Washington, D.C., you have a lot of other things going on, not the least of which is a revised edition of another book that you've done in the past, which I really enjoyed, Haunted Hollywood. Tell us what's up with that.
Well, they had, I really thought, here's an author woe story. I really thought that title would do well. I thought everyone wants to know about ghosts of the movie stars. And the original publisher, Globe Pequot Press, that was the publisher of this series, has been bought out by a larger publishing house now. Globe, their distribution was not good in regional titles. For instance, something like my Haunted Chicago would not have sold well with the old publishing house because they didn't have area distributors.
Right.
Roman, which still keeps Globe as a subsidiary, is really good in regional distributions. So they said, you know, we're going to keep Hollywood in print, even though its numbers were not doing as well as some of the other titles. And they said to me, this is the chance. Anytime there is a new printing, publishers now don't, unless you're a celebrity or Stephen King, they don't print 10,000 copies,
right,
or 40,000 copies. They print a couple of thousand because they have to warehouse them in between. With the print on demand being so inexpensive these days, they can print up a couple of thousand. And they said every time I had come up with a correction or an addition, they would put it in during the next printing.
Right.
They said, but we are now doing a new edition, meaning you can add up to 30,000 words.
Oh, my.
So if there are any other stories that you want to put in here and any corrections you want to make, now's the time to do it. And I was able to add a couple of restaurants I had found out since. The Mansion, which is the nickname of a recording studio up near where the alleged Houdini house was in one of the canyons. I was able to make a lot of corrections to the Magic Castle chapter, which was important to me since I'm a magician. But I also could add the story of Yamashiro Restaurant at the top of the hill, which somehow I had completely overlooked the first time around. And then I was able to make a couple of corrections. Houdini, they used to have an annual Houdini seance, but only the last one. In 1936, Houdini died in 26. The last one in 36 was held on the roof of the Knickerbocker. In my original edition, it had said annually held in the Knickerbocker. But the one that was most exciting to me, and I had a historian help work with this, there is in Hollywood, a famous story that the Vogue Theater, movie theater, was built on the site of a elementary school that was called Prospect Elementary School. It burned to the ground. 26 students were killed, including their teacher. And it's six of the kids, and occasionally the teacher would haunt the movie theater.
Oh, my.
And in addition, one of the early projectionists who worked there till he died, an old duffer, has been seen on the staircase, because they had a second, it was a second story, two-level movie theater. Well, I could not. This was the theater in Hollywood that was taken over for about 6-7 years by the ISPR, whose headquarters are in New Orleans, the International Society of Paranormal Research. They wanted a West Coast base, and it was the theater was up for lease. It had gone out of business as a movie theater, and they thought, we're better to have a, you know, our headquarters than a haunted facility. They claimed that when they left, they had helped all of the spirits move on. But I have not been able to find any record of an elementary school ever having stood on that site.
Huh.
I thought, why was it called Prospect Elementary? Hollywood Boulevard was originally Prospect Avenue, but that there wasn't a school there. And I had a local historian go back to the original Los Angeles Times microfilms. Mm-hmm. There was an elementary school fire, but it was on the east side of Hollywood. There was also, in other words, what happened is several incidents around that time occurred, and there's a little bit of the story in here and a little bit of that place and a little bit of that place. This became an amalgam story which somehow got attached to the Vogue Theater.
It's interesting how things do get switched around. You know, over the retelling, they live on, but it's like a game of generational telephone.
And it begs the same question as ghosts that appear in a building that was never there before, that they return to a spot into the next building that's built on the location. Or in the case of here in Los Angeles, there were a lot of old Victorian mansions in the originally downtown on what was called Bunker Hill that has now been leveled. There are theaters and office complexes up there. But some of the buildings were... One of the buildings was famously haunted. It, along with a couple of other buildings of the area, were moved about 5 miles outside of downtown and are kept in a museum park area that you can go and visit to see what these houses looked like in 1890. Mm-hmm. And the house that... This is a weird story because the house... One of the houses is haunted, but it's not the same house that was haunted on Bunker Hill. It's on the spot where the Bunker Hill house was originally moved to, and it burned down after it was moved, and a new house was put in its place. Hauntings are the same stories, that a woman appears in this corner of that room, that this goes on over there, the lights in this room flicker. So it's a story where the ghosts seem to have come with the building, but even when that building was destroyed, they then occupied what showed up next. It's almost as if they got lost. They couldn't move on to the next world. They were still here, but they didn't know where. It's almost like they were lost. They didn't know where to go.
Interesting.
And I'm wondering if that's a and now they inhabit this new building. And I wonder whether that's a sort of thing that somehow there were children who died in a fire, but not in a school on that site, but it wasn't a school and it was that era. And it was at a time when they were consolidating the schools of Hollywood because it was now becoming a larger and larger community. So it's just interesting to contemplate where the story came from and if the legend was really ever true about that particular building, or in the telling of the legend, did they get the name of the building wrong as to what was haunted.
Right. So I think that is fantastic. So obviously now that is coming out, or what's
that? That came out last summer.
Oh, excellent.
That was my last book. And now I'm working on one new project now that hopefully will be finished by the end of the year. And we'll talk about that later.
Yes, yes. I think, well, that I think is one of those things that that people will look forward to. And I'm not going to give it all away, but it does tie your long career, being on all these TV shows, doing all these performances for all these decades in magic with the paranormal. And I think that's very neat.
Which was the segue that got me into writing in and investigating the paranormal to begin with.
Well, there you go. We've come full circle. We've come full circle.
Oh, it's a circle of life.
Yes. Well, Tom.
Hakuna Matata.
Exactly. Tom, where can people get the new book, Haunted Washington, D.C.? And we'll have you on before Halloween, and we'll disclose more about
that. About the other, the new one.
Yes.
The easiest place is any online bookseller, any of the major ones, either Amazon or a place like, well, let's see, Borders doesn't exist anymore, but Barnes & Noble still has their online website. And it's called Haunted Washington, D.C., without the periods in D.C.
There you go. There you go. Tom Ogden has been our guest. The book is Haunted Washington, D.C. And I don't know what's scarier, Tom, the ghosts or the election.
It's funny. I just posted that on website. If you're too scared to think about the election, try this.
Exactly. It'll be a nice diversion. We thank you for joining us today and look forward to speaking to you next time.
Thank you.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that supersized paranormal podcast. I hope you'll tell a friend. And if you've stuck around this long, you must have enjoyed it. So please go over to iTunes and wherever you can to rate and review the shows. It means a lot. Also, you know, if you're with a friend who's into the paranormal, especially is, you know, won't be long till we're in September and October and Halloween mode, do me a favor. With their permission, take their phone in front of them and say, hey, I want to show you something. You can listen to all of these free shows on the Paranormal Podcast and Jim Harold's Campfire, and here's how you do it. Doesn't matter if they have an iOS iPhone or if they have an Android. These days, there's so many ways to listen. There's the podcast app on the iPhone. There's Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Play on Android. Also, you can listen on iHeartRadio and also on Spotify on iOS. There's also Stitcher Radio. I think I mentioned Google Play. There's so many ways to listen these days. Honestly, I forget about them all. I forget how many different ways they're listened. So much different and so exciting as this medium of podcasting just explodes. And we hope we could be a part of that growth. And with your help, I know that we can. I thank you so much for tuning in to the Paranormal Podcast. And we'll talk to you next time. Stay spooky. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.